Once upon a time, there were four little rabbits.
How old are you, Johnny? She asked.
16.
We few, we happy few, we band of brothers.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
A wise old king once said, "Of the making of books, there is no end." How true today. Of the overabundance of writing published each year, what's worth reading? The answer is simple. Read only the best. Come join the discussion on Just the Best Literature.
Hello again, everyone. Thanks for listening in today. Well, I don't have any comments today, and so that's probably a good thing because we want to jump right into today's program. Now, on our last program, we began to give you an introduction to the life of Charles Krauthammer. Remember, he did die in 2018. And we were reading from an essay that he wrote about one of his professors, Hermann Lisko. And I guess Hermann is really how you should say it. And we kind of had to cut the program short. And I just want to read the last sentence of this essay. And he said, "Those who were touched by this man," this is Krauthammer writing about Hermann Lisko. He says, "Those who were touched by this man, so wise and gracious and goodly, mourn him. I mourn a man who saved my life." And so if you look at Krauthammer, he really did love life. And even though he had that horrible accident of being totally paralyzed from the neck down, he did not give up. And we do know that he did do a lot of changing. He was really highly educated. He was a medical doctor, but his true love in life, I believe, was politics. And so he eventually gave up that medical profession, even though Hermann Lisko had worked so hard to get him graduated from it. But it's still, anything you do in life to become educated, you never lose it, and it always can help in other ways. Well, today what I want to do is I want to delve deeper into Charles Krauthammer's true, maybe you should call it his true love of his life, and that was politics. And he did such a masterful job of it. Even this book of essays that we're reading won the Pulitzer Prize. So to help me do this, with me in the studio today, again, is my companion in literature and my ever-sweet wife, Deborah. So welcome back, Deborah.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So let's talk about Krauthammer, and he calls it, he does talk about this in the introduction to the book. And, he talks about his education, and of course, there's some really funny stories from McGill, where he ran into, I think it kind of laid the groundwork for what he was going to be later, that you have the liberals and you have the conservatives, and he got kind of in the middle of it, and that's why he wrote that first essay all the way back in the 60s. So in some ways, when I've been reading this introduction, I realize that let's see, he died in 2018 at 68, and so I'm just 67, so he's just a couple years older than I am. And so, but we're both children of the 60s, and I have to be honest. He sees the sovereignty of politics. I hated politics. I'm so glad that we aren't, like, really politically motivated, either one of us, and that we can talk about this a little bit more. But he does say that after all that education he had, it's politics that really gripped him and really spurred him to become the writer that he became. And so I thought maybe we ought to just talk about this a little bit. This is on pages 2, 3, and 4 for all of you out there that are reading the book. I suggest when we cover certain sections, I really hope you're reading the whole book. And what I try and teach my students here is if you're going to read a book, you need to read the introduction. And because you're going to miss a lot if you don't. He says on this page, I'm going to read from the second paragraph. He says, "Accordingly, this book was originally going to be a collection of my writings about everything but politics. Things beautiful, mysterious, profound, or just odd. The working title was There's More to Life Than Politics. But in the end, I couldn't. For a simple reason, the same reason I left psychiatry for journalism. While science, medicine, art, poetry, architecture, chess, space, sports, number theory, and all things hard and beautiful promise purity, elegance, and sometimes even transcendence, they are fundamentally subordinate. In the end, they must bow to the sovereignty of politics. So I have to admit that kind of gives me the willies to think about that. So my parents, my father was a Republican, my mother was a Democrat, and they had some pretty fiery discussions over things. And it was at that time that I developed this aversion to politics. But here's what he goes on to say. Politics, the crooked timber of our communal lives, dominates everything because in the end, everything high and low, and most especially high, lives or dies by politics. You can have the most advanced and effervescent of cultures. Get your politics wrong, however, and everything stands to be swept away. Now, if you just stop there, you think about, what's he talking about? And so this is where he always has what I call the zingers that get you going. And not only does it in a whole essay, he does it with some of these paragraphs.
Mm-hmm. True.
He said, this is not ancient history. This is Germany, 1933. So,
and there you go. You understand what he's talking about. He does it very clearly. Okay, this is what he means.
This is what I mean. It's like, hey, come on. Politics can be benign or they can be malign. Or maybe I should say malign. Or I was going to say malignity. Or they could be full of malignity, but they're malign. So let's talk about this. Let's go on. I'll let you do some talking now. So.
Yes, well, it was really interesting because, like yourself, sometimes I don't want to bother with politics. But what he's saying is if the politics are wrong, if our government does not allow us the freedoms to, you can't have art, poetry, science, and all that. And
right.
you know, the history shows, and he says, this is no abstraction. We see it in North Korea, whose deranged Stalinist politics has created a land of stunning desolation, ugliness, both spiritual and material. We saw it in China's Cultural Revolution, a sustained act of national self-immolation designed to dethrone, debase, and destroy the highest achievements of 5 millennia of Chinese culture. It's true, they did try to get rid of a lot of the Chinese culture, you know, all the arts.
I think you know, I mean, you know this, that I have, you know, the minor in fine arts, and I love studying Chinese pottery and Chinese art. And it's true, when they took over, when the communists took over, they destroyed all of that. You know, the beauty of that. You know, the thing that I think here is that what I really like. I mean, this is what really kind of this whole paragraph really, really inspired me. Was he starts talking about Keats.
Oh, yes.
I, undergraduate, my mm-hmm. degree was in the Romantic. And basically, I spent a lot of time with mm-hmm. Romantic poets, and Keats was my favorite. He says, beauty is truth, truth is beauty. That is all you know on earth, and all you need to know. Every school child is fed. But even Keats, poet, romantic, and early 19th century man, oblivious to the horrors of the century to come, kept quotational distance from such blissful innocence. Turns out we need to know one more thing on earth, politics, because of its capacity, when benign, to allow all around it to flourish, and its capacity, when malign, to make all around it wither. And so I think that's really a great statement. And I do want to say to our listeners out there that I'm really growing in my understanding of politics, and I really see the need to really understand it. We have certain beliefs here that, you know, we don't necessarily need to go into now, but politics and government, maybe I should even say it that way, government is very important, and you better have right government or you are going to have, what, no culture. I mean, it's going to be really bad. Over there it says on page 3, and on that paragraph that talks about politics there, it says, politics is the moat, the walls beyond which lie the barbarians. fail to keep them at bay, and everything burns. The entire 20th century, with its mass political enthusiasms, is a lesson in the supreme power of politics to produce ever-expanding circles of ruin. Now, I believe he's really right there, but to me, it's not just politics, it's government. It's how you administer government. And to me, that's an easier way for me to understand this because, like I said, I have this grinding hatred of the word politics because of what I was told. And I know, even as a child, my dad would say to me, now you've got to be a Republican or you're not going to get a good job, you know. My mother was just opposite that, you know. So anyway, it's really kind of funny how those kind of things can really warp your mind as a young child. It says World War I not only killed more people than any previous war, the psychological shock of Europe's senseless self-inflicted devastation forever changed Western sensibilities, practically overthrowing the classical arts, virtues, and modes of thought. Now, we just covered a lot of that in the Korda book. And if you look at the Middle East today, it's really what really has disrupted the Middle East, what's made it what it is today, is bad politics or bad government. And so like I said to all of our listeners out there, I'm learning. You know, I'm growing in my understanding. So he said the Russian Revolution and its imitators, the Chinese, the Cuban, the Vietnamese, the Cambodian, tried to atomicize society so thoroughly to war against the mediating structures that stand between the individual and the state that the most basic bonds of family, faith, fellowship, and conscience came to near dissolution. And I think it's really to understand what Krauthammer is saying, I think, and you can agree with me or disagree with me, is you have to have kind of like a real love for all the people in this world. If you really care about people, if you really care about what's happening in the world, then you're going to be interested in the government or the politics and why it's, I mean, we've all, growing up, we've all heard about what happened in Cambodia. We've all heard what happened in Vietnam. And sometimes I think in America, we've just been kind of sheltered of it because we've had so much. So I don't know if you agree with what I'm saying there or not. So,
well, I can see what you're saying. Yes, that we should. I mean, there's been a lot of suffering in the world, and a lot of the suffering has been caused by totalitarian governments and other, you know, different kinds of governments. And so, it's true that, you know, we do care about other people in the world. Is that what you're talking about?
Right. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And it seems like. Mm-hmm. He's not saying that directly, but you kind of get the feeling that he believed that.
Yes.
That Krauthammer believed that he, you know, for kind of going to some of these really scholarly schools, the fact that he's come out conservative is really kind of surprising, you know, with his conservative approach. He said, of course, the greatest demonstration of the finality of politics is the Holocaust, which in less than a decade destroyed a millennium-old civilization, sweeping away not only 6 million souls, but the institutions, the culture, the very tongue of the now-vanished world of European Jewry. And so you know, on one of our other programs this week, the host of the program was talking about, you know, forgetting history, and people want to forget the Holocaust. You know, people don't want to keep it in focus, and yet that's history. And I think that's what Krauthammer is saying here as well, is, you know, you've got to look at, there is a history of bad government in this world, but still you've got young people in this country now embracing communism, they're embracing socialism, you know, they're embracing all these things, and look at what it's done to the world, but they don't even see it.
They're not being taught history. They're not being taught this.
No.
Yes.
No. And of course, you know, he was, you know, he did somehow, you know, get it right. You know, and I think he saw some of this at McGill. You know how, you know, you've got the right and the left, and how they're always going to be fighting each other. I think it's interesting on page 3 when he says, "And yet, even God cannot match the cruelty of His creation." That's an astounding statement.
Yes, it is, because he talks about how, you know, sometimes they say that, you know, so-called natural disasters, and you know, the people might say that God, you know, created those disasters, but he says not even God cannot match the cruelty of the creation. Yes, the evil of man. He sees the evil in man, the possibility of evil in man.
And savagery.
Yes.
Yeah, the savagery of man. And of course, we've been, you know, in our literature classes, we're finishing up Heart of Darkness by Joseph Conrad. And he saw the savage aspect of man, and he saw the evil in society. And he wrote that because he saw the evil in society. And so there's some greats that see it, and then, you know, there are other ones, you know, that can't see it. And of course, we'll get into that in here in a few minutes when we talk about his essay on the difference between conservatives and liberals. So, but I think the one thing in this introduction that he brings out, where he talks about John Adams, and I think we've done, you know, several. I know, especially Mr. Stephen Fleury has talked about John Adams quite a bit. But I do think, again, this introduction is just chock full of so much information. But it's easy to read, and it's easy to understand, and it's easy to pick it out. And the first full paragraph of, you know, page 4 says, the most considered and balanced statement of politics place in the hierarchy of human discipline comes naturally from an American. I must study politics and war, wrote John Adams, that my sons may have the liberty to study mathematics and philosophy, geography, natural history, and naval architecture, navigation, commerce, and agriculture, in order to give their children a right to study painting, poetry, music, architecture, statuary, tapestry, and porcelain. I think that's obviously he studied Adams.
Yes.
And again, he brings out, I think, that's a true point. If you don't have the government right, there's no one going to have the right education. And I think even Dwight Fault brought that up on the Trumpet Daily. You know, look what happened to communism in Russia. So many people forget about the gulags. You know, they forget about, you know, how they emptied the prisons to get enough soldiers to fight in World War II. And then once the war was over, they put them back in the prisons. It's really kind of crazy. But Adams, you know, one of the, Krauthammer brings up later, one of the angry white men saw something that people don't see today.
It's amazing. He saw that before communism, you know, was in the world. Yeah, he says, Adams saw clearly that politics is the indispensable foundation for things elegant and beautiful. To me, reading this is amazing. I hadn't thought of things that way before, but just a great way of looking at it.
Yeah, so we're getting educated in a different way.
Yes.
Yeah. It goes on to say, first, above all, she must secure life, liberty, and the right to pursue your own happiness. That's politics done right, hard-earned, often by war, and yet the glories yielded by such a successful politics lie outside itself. Its deepest purpose is to create the conditions for the cultivation of the finer things, beginning with philosophy and science, and ascending to the ever more delicate and refined arts. Note Adams' double reference to architecture. The second generation must study naval architecture, a hybrid discipline of war, commerce, and science, before the third can freely and securely study architecture for its own sake. And so, you know, I think that's great. But there's one point before we move on. I want to talk about one other thing so we don't run out of time in this program. But he says here, the most optimistic implication of Adams' dictum is that once the first generation gets the political essentials right, they remain intact to nurture the future. And so I mean, look where America's headed today. I mean, our politics are not right. And if we could bring John Adams back to life, can you imagine how insane he would be at seeing what's happening? And of course, you know, George Washington did not like the two-party system because he felt it would break down into factions. Look what's happened. We have the two-party factions, and it's fractured. The government in this country is fractured. So anyway, that's why he got back into writing, because of the sovereignty of politics. And so I like to say the sovereignty of government, that makes it easier for me. Again, I still get the willies when I hear the word politics. All right. Now, he takes us to a whole nother level with his essay on the central axiom of partisan politics. And again, I think this is really a great essay. And I'm being changed in my thinking about politics. So this is really kind of funny. I mean, I think his essays are interesting. I think they're really pithy, but I think they can be absolutely hilarious at the same time. So if you don't mind, I'd like to read the first paragraph. Because I know that you want to read it, but I want to read it. All right. To understand the workings of American politics, you have to understand this fundamental law. Now he's talking about the laws of politics. This is great. I've got my mind on government these days, and I've got my mind on law these days. So listen to this out there. All of you people listening in, get this. Conservatives think liberals are stupid. That's one part of the law. Liberals think conservatives are evil. that sums up what's happening, you know, in Washington, D.C. right now. I mean, you know, we know, we believe President Trump has an office of the president. It's an office that should be respected. All of us see that he could probably do things differently. You know, it's not like I'm the biggest Trump supporter. But this is what's going on. Liberals think he's evil.
That's right. Basically, he's evil. And anybody who's a Trump supporter is evil. It's just the way it is.
And of course, President Trump thinks all the liberals are stupid.
Right.
And he says it all the time.
That's right. Yeah, that's true.
So Krauthammer had something here. But the point is, you know, there's certain political, how should I say that, there's a way to be nice about certain things, and then instead of being hard, but now we're at the point where everybody's just hard on everybody else. He said, let me just go on for the second paragraph. He said, for the first side of this equation, I need no sources. As a conservative, I can confidently attest that whatever else my colleagues might disagree about, Bosnia, John McCain, precisely how many orphans were prepared to throw into the snow so the rich can have their tax cuts, we all agree the liberals are stupid. But he goes on to say, but we mean this, of course, in the nicest way. So there, I think Charles Krauthammer had some finesse. You know, so he said, liberals tend to be nice, and they believe, and here is where they go stupid, that most everybody else is nice too. Deep down, that is. Sure, you've got your multiple felon and your occasional war criminal, but they're undoubtedly depraved because they've been deprived. Now, we've heard that.
That, you know where that's from? That is from West Side Story. And there is that one song where the
Jets
the Jets are talking about, and it's a song. We're depraved because we're deprived. You know.
Oh yeah. Oh, that's the liberal thinking right there. Mm-hmm. If only we could get social conditions right, eliminate poverty, teach anger management, restore the ozone, arrest John Ashcroft, who is a very smart, super conservative, who did not want to make pot legal, you know. Everyone would be holding hands, smiley face, rocking back and forth till we shall overcome. So he's definitely a child of the 60s.
Yes. So, and I remember that. I used to be one of those people many years ago. So, yeah. But
I was just selfishly into my own things. So. He says, liberals suffer incurably from naivete, the stupidity of the good heart. Who else but the oracle of American liberalism, the New York Times, could run the puzzled headline, crime keeps on falling, but prisons keep on filling. But how about this wild theory? If you lock up the criminals, the crime declines. So So again, this is just really a great essay. He said, accordingly, the conservative attitude towards liberals is one of compassionate condescension. Liberals are not quite as reciprocally charitable. It is natural. They think conservatives are mean. How can conservatives believe in the things they do? Self-reliance, self-discipline, competition, military power without being soulless. How to understand the conservative desire to actually abolish welfare if it is not to punish the poor? The argument that it would increase self-reliance and thus ultimately reduce poverty is dismissed as meaningless, rationalized, or as Representative Major Owens, a Democrat from New York, put it colorfully in a recent House debate on welfare reform, a cold-blooded grab for another pound of flesh from the demonized welfare mothers. That sounds so much like today.
I know. He wrote this, when was it? Back in 2002. So,
Yeah.
You see the politics of, you know, still the same thing, just different people, different people.
Yeah, this is really funny. Okay, a couple more things. I'm going to let you, those of you out there are going to have to read this for yourself, but I just have to just talk about this one thing. It says, liberals who have no head, and he says, see above, that means Representative Major Owens. He said, liberals who have no head believe that conservatives have no heart, you know, and that's really true, and it's not true. You know, and then towards the end of the essay, he does talk about how there are some of the liberals have actually come to understand that some of the conservatives are actually pretty nice.
Yes, and it's like they can't understand it.
They can't grasp it.
It's possible that the conservative could actually be a nice person.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right. So hopefully by now, all of you listeners out there are really. Really sold on getting this book and starting to read it. Well, that's all the time we have for today's program. So next time, we'll continue our discussion of Charles Krauthammer's book, Things That Matter, and I will have a new special guest with me at that time. So remember, this series is meant to be a special tribute to the life and work of Charles Krauthammer. You can buy this book at Amazon.com. You can find a used copy of the book at abebooks.com. And of course, you can also check your local library. So please write me any comments you may have to jbl@pcog.org. You can follow JBL on Twitter at JBLiterature1. You can also follow JBL on Facebook. Simply search for Just the Best Literature. And I just want to say we're upgrading all those social media sites so that you can get quotes almost every day, new quotes all the time. So until next time, keep reading.
Been listening to Just the Best Literature on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, streaming online at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com.